My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself. At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Today on The Grave Talks, the Statler City Hotel. A room and a bath for a dollar and a half. That was the original slogan of Buffalo's Statler Hotel. A hotel which originally catered to the average income traveler, gave him the opportunity for small luxuries in a hotel setting. It was built for the convenience of the average traveler and was originally scorned by many higher class travelers because they seemed to cater to the lower income masses. Three towering segments of this hotel became increasingly successful, much to the surprise of more prominent businessmen in the hotel field. The Buffalo Statler Hotel, despite its ability to cater to those of lesser means, also played host to many notable characters, including Elvis and mobster Al Capone, staying there. Today, the building still stands high in the skyline of Buffalo. However, it's no longer used as a hotel. Only the lower floors are used for banquet facilities and meeting places. But the vacant floors of the hotel, some would argue, are not so empty. Spirits of those who once lived there, who once worked there, still roam them to this day. Connor Hawkins joins us to discuss the history and the current state of the Statler City Hotel.
Well, I worked for the owner of the hotel. I've been involved with the hotel since we took it over. Back in, I think it was 2010, the actual building itself was going to go into receivership. They talked about knocking it down. Obviously, the owner I work for stepped in, saved the building. So our goal was to try and refurbish the first three floors, get them open for banquets, and maybe try and work on the floors going up. In the floor, it's the hotel itself. When it first opened back in 1923, it was one of the biggest hotels in the country. It had 1,100 rooms, 18 floors, and 950,000 square feet. So it's been derelict for a few years. Back in that, it was derelict since 2007, up until we took over in 2009 and started reconstruction. So there's an awful lot of work still to be done.
Let's go back in time to a place before the hotel was even constructed. What was life like in the area of Buffalo where this behemoth of a hotel was eventually erected?
It was built in 1923, and before the hotel was there, there was a home there, and the home was the house that Millard Fillmore stayed in when he was at UB, Buffalo University. So it's kind of unique that, you know, it was a home of a former president. Mm-hmm. And of course, many presidents have been there. But before that, I mean, it's right downtown. It's right in the center of Buffalo. It's right on Niagara Square. You know, it came before Buffalo City Hall, which was just across the street from it, too.
And eventually, this hotel is put up in the city, reaching high into the sky, taller than almost anything else in the area. It truly stands out as an amazing structure.
When it was constructed, life was good. It was back in the, you know, days where you had the Pan American Exposition. Just after that, Buffalo was one of the biggest cities in the country. People were working on the canal, and there's a lot of people there in Buffalo. I mean, as the years come around, the canals get different. The St. Lawrence Riverway you know, doesn't use the Erie Canal as much to get the boats up into the Great Lakes. It starts slowing down a little bit, and the buffalo winters, people are moving out. But back in 1920, Buffalo was a very vibrant spot. You know, it was one of the biggest cities in the country, as I say, and there was a lot of work.
What made it so unique was the fact that the hotel, although be it very luxurious and fancy for its time, it still very much welcomed in the average income traveler. It wasn't exclusively for the ultra rich of the day.
The hotel itself was very elegant, beautiful, maybe Victorian style. I mean, classic ballrooms. It was one of the first hotels in the country that had actual bathrooms inside each hotel room. And even though back in 1923, you know, the marketing slogan for the hotel itself was a bed and a bath for $1.50, which was still a lot of money back in those days, because back in 1923 was a lot of money. But this was a great hotel. I mean, it had great supper rooms. It had, you know, great events, great entertainers coming in. Then it was just the place to be. It was the jewel of downtown Buffalo.
How about some of the names, some of the people that came and stayed there, that came and went through those doors?
Well, back in the day, we know Capone stayed there. We know Marilyn Monroe stayed there. We know Dean Martin performs on our Golden Ballroom stage. We know that Tony Bennett recorded an album there in our downtown bar, which closed in 1985. He recorded there. There was Dizzy Gillespie, used to play there, you know, for a spell of months on end. The McPartland brothers played there, entertainers. I know I've seen some pictures of movie people, you know, having big dinners there. And again, in Buffalo, it was the scenes of many of the glamorous events, black tie dinners. Anybody had to be seen. This is the place to be seen.
Good times happening at the hotel. Well, those good times could not last forever. At some point, the grandeur of the hotel wore thin.
With Ellsworth Statler, who created the hotel, was, you know, the first hotelier. He died, and I believe it was maybe late 20s. His family took over, and, you know, there was some sort of internal family bickering, and the daughter got married, and she committed suicide. But other people think it was murder. And but they had a host of hotels they built around the country. And back in 1954, one of the largest real estate transactions ever in the country, I think there were six hotels involved, was sold to the Hilton Group for $111 million. And the Buffalo Statler was one, sorry, the Buffalo Statler became the Buffalo Hilton, or the Hilton Statler. And then, again, they were not, back in the 50s, a bit of a depression going on. It wasn't so glamorous in Buffalo. It changed hands in the 70s to some local real estate people. And at that stage, some of the hotel floors became into apartments. Then after that, they started becoming into more of a office space, you know, attorney's offices. Then at the end there, back in 2008, you know, they had a couple of floors of workers' comp, the parole board. There was all different offices. In fact, the hotel stopped being in use, I believe. I think it was late 78, or it could have been as late as 82. But I know, reading some different books, there were some famous people that, you know, lived in those condos too, those apartments. I know Tim Horton. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Tim Horton's coffee is a very popular coffee, being in Buffalo, because it's right on the Canadian border, and him being a Canadian hockey player. He actually lived here, and he was driving back from Toronto to the hotel, to the Statler, when he died, when he, you know, crashed his car. So, and Punch Him, like another famous Buffalo Sabres coach, general manager, lived in the building too. So quite a few people have lived in the building also.
Eventually, when the 80s came around, people started leaving the hotel. It was primarily office space, and then even that ended at some point. Is that the time where the building began to sit essentially abandoned, just a ghost of its former self?
There was a guy by the name of Bill Hassett, and he sold it to an English guy by the name of Brasher Isha. And Brasher Isha came from Manchester. He was originally from Dubai, had great plans for the thing, and, you know, made the news. Everybody was, you know, great, this is going to be exciting. It's going to be a multi-use building. There's going to be a hotel. There's going to be some apartments. And, you know, he had people work in it, and they were doing some work renovating the hotel rooms, but he didn't pay anybody, and he was having some money issues. So he couldn't pick up, he couldn't pay the bills in the building, in the receivership then. So people that were actually working in the building got notice. They had 2 weeks to try and find somewhere else to move into, and the building got boarded up then.
Boarded up for several years, the fate of the hotel lie in question. Until one day, one man decided he was going to take it upon himself to try and resurrect this building.
Well, it was going for, it was in bankruptcy court, and, you know, it was going for a very little amount of money. It was going for about $200,000 with $500,000 in back taxes. My boss, who I work for, has had a lot of properties downtown, and this was a building that's 950,000 square feet. It had so much history. I guess it would have cost the state maybe $14 million to knock it down. I don't think anybody else wanted to buy it. So my boss went up and, you know, he said, okay, I'll pay the money. I'll take it over. And he got it.
When he decided to take on such a project, such a monstrosity, what was his thought process? What was his goals for the building?
Well, the goals were it had some sort of structural problems on the outside, that, you know, some of the loose terracotta was falling off the building. There was a lot of, the roofs were very bad in the building, so there was a lot of water coming into the building. There was a lot of mold, a lot of the paintwork was coming in. So the whole goal was to try and, you know, secure the building. We put some sort of sidewalk scaffolding around to kind of secure people on the sidewalks of any fallen masonry. We secured, put a new roof in on the third floor in the middle of the towers and the back section of the starter itself. So we could start doing stuff inside. Obviously, then we built up a lobby bar in the front. We renovated all four ballrooms, all four major ballrooms in the building. And, you know, like replacing the floors, whole new paint job. We had to rip the floor up, and we saved the wooden floor from the original golden ballroom floor and had it treated and put it back down again. So there was a lot of work. We had to make a lot of moldings of some of the ceilings and the crown moldings just to put it back up there and make it look the way it used to. We didn't really want to change the way it looked. We put a beautiful koi pond in the front of that main lobby that is kind of new. We just made it look better and cleaner and cleaned everything up. And now, obviously, when it first opened, we put about $7 million into it. We've had it for so many years. There's been a couple million dollars spent just on the masonry around the building. So all the scaffolding's coming away. This summer is going to be a brand new marquee. There's going to be a new roof going on each tower. This is going to happen early this spring. So then you'll be able to kind of work your way down from the 18th floor the whole way down. Because you have that new roof, there's no water coming in. There's no dampness, mold or anything that's going to happen. And hopefully, I mean, right now, the second, third, fourth, well, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth floor are all good. They're in good shape. They look good. They have everything working. They can be kind of, it's not going to take much to put those in use for some sort of office space. you know, we've used those floors just recently for the movie I Am Marshall, just filming the lot in the building. And we've done some other films like Gay Marriage Inside. So those floors are a little bit kind of older in style, but a coat of paint and they're good to go.
When you began the renovation of the hotel and you started going room to room, working on various projects, obviously things started happening. Things that were unexplained, things that were not just an animal in the building or the building settling. Let's talk about that a little bit.
My first strange thing, as soon as I walked in, this is before when the owner was, you know, talking about taking this building over and looking at it, and there's an old caretaker, John Kinger, and myself, the owner, and another guy walked into the building. It was a January evening. It was dark, cold in Buffalo. And we walked around some of the floors. And I was in one of the ballrooms. It's called the terrace room. And I was in the terrace room, and everybody else was in the golden ballroom. So I heard a door open and some footsteps. And I kind of followed them, and I kind of sort of went up the stairs, and there was nobody there. And it was kind of alarming. Totally okay. I came last, and you know, didn't think too much of it till I started getting in there, and we took it over, and I was in there a lot of days. Probably till we, when we stopped doing the work and we started opening, did I hear more things, and that the staff that worked for me there, that they heard noises, they heard doors banging, they heard voices, they heard footsteps. There's a lot of activity then. You know, I mean, I've experienced lots of it myself. I don't know, it was just being there more, or just being a bit more open to it.
It sounds like there's far more than just one spirit roaming the halls of this hotel. It sounds like there's many different ones, maybe with different agendas, many different forces at play here.
Oh, there is many, many different spirits in the building. You know, since we've been in there in 2009, you know, I run ghost tours on a regular basis. And I find that there's a lot of many different energies. You know, there was a lot of death in the building. There was murders. We had two Buffalo firefighters that died inside the building, one back in the 20s and one in 1944. There was a fire that took the life of an employee. There's a lot of people have checked into the hotel and never checked out. Some people have committed suicide by jumping from the building. I think we know of people who have jumped from the 8th floor to 14th floor to 15th floor to 16th floor. And we've found these by different newspaper articles. There's another employee that got crushed in an elevator. So there's a lot of sad stories about the hotel. I mean, obviously, a lot of good stories. There's a lot of sad stories of people came there due to being depressed, and, you know, depression wasn't really something that was talked about back in, you know, maybe the 30s, 40s, 50s, and there's no kind of medication for it. So people came there to maybe end their lives. Why would they go there? Maybe because they didn't want their family to find them, or you know, they didn't want to do it, you know, in their own houses. I mean, I'll never know the answer for that, but there's a lot of history and a lot of people have passed in the building.
One of the rumored more haunted rooms in the hotel is the terrace room. What's happened there?
Yeah, I mean, I never have too many problems in there. I mean, I think the rendezvous room is probably the most haunted because there's more activity down there and we've had great EVPs. The terrace room, you know, has been where I've heard footsteps. And we've got a figure that was a picture taken at a wedding by a guest. And they sent it in to me. And so I first kind of, you know, there's something like that right now. I was hearing footsteps, maybe seeing shadows. Maybe some of that stuff can be explained. But when you see a strange shadow figure that resembles a human torso and a picture that a wedding guest sends. And then, you know, with my first, I started calling some of paranormal groups to come and check it out. Anybody who's came in and checked it out have been extremely happy because they think it's one of the most active places they've ever been. when the first group came in, checked it out. To be fair, I mean, they were probably a newer group too, and they didn't have as much equipment as many groups would have these days. You know, it was more of the old Spirit Box 7 and, you know, maybe Mega Lights and maybe some K2s and just some voice recorders, maybe a night vision camera. So some of the equipment was maybe a bit limited. And, but they're still getting some great evidence. You know, they had, you know, heat sensors and stuff like that. And there was just, they were getting questions to answers. Sorry, they were getting answers to questions. I mean, there were just things they were asking. They were getting, you know, clear answers back. I remember the first group come in, you know, and I was walking around with them, and we asked them a few different questions about my name. I get Connor and I get Boss and what country I'm from, and it's coming through very clearly, Ireland, and just a lot of the answers were just spot on. You know, it's just hard to not, you know, take notice. But going through the years, the different groups coming in and even having Paranormal Lockdown go in there and do it, it's just so many different things. We've found that there's been so many different entities. There's so many different spirits that want to communicate. We have communications with, you know, different spirits that we kind of know by name, and they're willing and they want to communicate.
Have you been able to connect names of people who were in the building historically with the names of the people who are still haunting the building today?
Yeah, we tied one into a person that worked on a radio station in the 50s that was on top of the building. And his name was Phil. I forget the last name, but he was like a station manager, and, you know, he's kind of always been there. We've tied another person, Steve, a little bit angrier. And, you know, we know that he was an attorney that worked on the 7th floor when it turned into different offices, and he's still there working. He's just attached to his desk, and he's still there working. We know there's a couple of people by the name of Carl, but we think he's just we don't know if he's a bartender or just a drinker at the bar. But we haven't really tied into too many people that have actually, some of the people that have actually jumped. Haven't got too much. One of the firefighters that passed in 44, his name was Edward, and we get a lot of responses. Who is this? It's Edward. But we're still can't get him to, you know, get the energy to say, hey, you know, he was a firefighter. Mm-hmm.
Some hotels hold the rumor of the 13th floor. Some hotels don't even have a 13th floor. With this hotel, it's the 18th floor that's particularly active.
The 18th floor is a floor, a regular front main elevators don't go to. You only go to 17th, and they would walk up the last floor, but the service elevator goes. Back in the day, we believed that, we know that higher-end management would live on the 18th floor, some lower-level management would live on the second, lower-level employees would kind of stay on the second floor. We know the first manager, I think his name is William Green, died in the 18th floor, had a heart attack in his hotel room. He was the hotel general manager for 23 years. The second general manager also had a heart attack on the 18th floor in his suite, and he was there for about 7 years. You know, I'm sure natural causes, but we don't know. They're still kind of roaming the hotel. We know by reading the obituaries that, you know, they died in the hotel. But, again, we kind of ask for them. And we get responses, but we just haven't got that concrete, yes, EVP telling us that's them, you know.
Another area in hotels that often have a lot of energy surrounding them, even when they're no longer active, is the pool. I hear this quite frequently with haunted hotels. Tell us about the pool at the Statler.
In the pool area, I know people have used dark and maybe more of a scary nature. I mean, I don't get scared too much down there. I mean, I think I've been touched down there. I felt some person holding my hand, and, you know, a thermal camera in one hand was of a normal temperature, and the other one was like, you know, 20 degrees colder. There's been people that kind of got nudged down there. They were kind of walking down the stairs into the pool, and so like, they kind of get pushed. I know in Paranormal Lockdown, they got like some stones thrown, and people say dark. Some of the psychic mediums I've had down there think it's a little bit more darker. But I wouldn't really go to say that myself. You know, I think it's just more of it's in the pool area. I don't know. Maybe it's just angry. I don't know if anyone's died in the pool. I have no evidence of anybody dying in the pool. So I don't know if it's somebody upset that they drowned. I mean, that I haven't really get around to research. And a lot of the research from the building or the people that pass is done by a lot of the people that come on our tours and really, really get, you know, into the Statler. Their parents have worked there. Or, you know, some of the family members have worked there, and they do a lot of the research for us. The pool itself is still there. It's empty. It's been empty for a long, long time. It's a beautiful pool, beautiful craftsmanship, some great tile jobs. It's just very, very pretty the whole way around. It is still there, and the showers are there, and the kind of changing room areas. And we don't really go take people down there. I don't take my groups down there when I'm doing ghost tours, because it's hard to navigate the way too, the way the whole building's changed over the years. And sometimes I've went there and I haven't had much luck when I'm investigating, and other times I've went there and it's just very active. Sometimes I go there and it's active. There's a lot of activity above us on the in the terrace room, and you hear people trailing furniture and pulling chairs, and that's just the most bizarre thing in the world, knowing that there's nobody else in the building. But when you're in the pool area, you feel like someone's setting up a party and there's chairs and stuff getting moved around. I think that's some of the best evidence we've ever caught, you know, being down there and having cameras and recorders going and having maybe four or five investigators just look at each other in sheer amazement and going, wow.
You've probably spent more time in the hotel in recent years than most. I want to ask you about your personal experiences in the hotel. What have been some of the most standout moments between you and the undead?
For me, well, quite a few. One night, I've been in the building a lot, and I've been in all our buildings a lot, any kind of building we do have, the alarm goes off late at night. I have to go into the building and reset the alarm. I'm in the building, you know, some nights to close the place up. And if I go to close the place up, normally I bring my dog with me and he just runs around. It was one night, the alarm goes off. It's about 5:15 in the morning. I go to check out on this alarm. I bring my dog with me, and the alarm motion tells me it's in a restroom in the rendezvous room, which is in the lower level, it's in the basement. So I tried to pick my dog down there, but my dog wouldn't leave the top of the steps. He refused to go. He whimpered a little bit, which was kind of strange, but, you know, I asked him to come on. He wouldn't come. So I went downstairs, turned on the lights on. I checked out the restrooms. When I got into one of the second sort of restrooms, I opened the door and someone said hello to me. So the hairs in the back of my neck, my goosebumps, all hairs all standing up. It's giving me goosebumps. I'm kind of shocked. I looked around. There's nobody there. You know, I just kind of checked the restrooms real quick. And, you know, I was just kind of really eager to get out of the place very fast, because it just took me by surprise, because it's the first time that, you know, I've heard some talk to me. Another time I had a police officer that was wanting to walk around the place, and we were going to check out the 14th floor. And it was kind of really weird. I'm walking down the hallway, and all the whole place is winterized, so all the windows are closed. There's no draft, there's no air coming out. But we're walking down this hallway, and all of a sudden, the door just slams right in front of us. You know, this police officer's freaking out. He's reaching for his gun. I'm like startled. I was actually getting to the stage where I kind of wanted just to not be in that floor anymore. I wanted to leave that floor because I just felt the heaviness. I just felt there was something not right. And I don't know why. Either it was because there was a police officer with me and the spirit didn't like the police. I had no idea. But that was very startling. I've had another incident downstairs in the lobby bar where I'm talking to some people. It's a business meeting. I'm talking to some radio guys about advertising. And we're talking about how the building is paranormal stuff is going on. And as we're talking, you know, as a like a little statue just fell off the shelf, just kind of pushed off the shelf as if to say, yeah, this is real. And the kind of guys I'm talking to were like kind of freaked out. And so that has been pretty cool. Some of the pictures we've taken recently are very, very cool also. I mean, we got two people walking above the balcony and on the balcony of the Golden Ballroom, which is, I was there when the pictures were taken. I didn't take the pictures. They were taken by a guest, and they, you know, we seen them that night, and they texted them to me. It's just very, very weird. So there's been a lot of different things, and as we're going along, seeing some of the stuff and seeing a chair move and paranormal lockdown was kind of freaky too. But there's been a lot of cool things. You know, I mean, right now we got a webcam up there for Paranormal Warehouse. It's got a webcam that you can tune into and look at it. And, you know, it's got audio equipment at nighttime. You know, people hear whispering and they hear coughing and they hear people talking. So it's kind of exciting. You know, for me, when I'm doing my tours, you know, be it going around with, you know, some of my equipment, be it, you know, a spirit box or a Poltercon or some Power 360s, you know, or K2s. Some of the places you just get, you know, amazing results. And sometimes you come in, you don't get anything. But that's the beauty of the investigation.
What does the future hold for the building itself? Obviously, restoration on the bottom floors has been going well. But what about the structure as a whole? Where do you see that going in the coming years?
The plan is to turn the building into multi-use again and have it to be a 24/7 building. Right now, it is a banquet facility with the, you know, four big ballrooms and a couple of smaller ones that we use a lot. Our goal is to, you know, get some tenants in there and have some more office space, but our goal eventually is to, you know, build maybe three floors of hotel rooms and build three floors of condos and maybe have a bit of a space in between. So if the apartment condos is doing well, we can build down and use some of the other floors. Or if the hotel floors are doing well, then you can kind of build up and do more. I mean, it's a very big building. It's, you know, 18 floors, and you know, we're never going to have 1,100 hotel rooms like we used to. Back in that building, or that was never, Buffalo couldn't sustain. You know, I think if it's ever going to be a hotel again, it'll be, you know, a mid-cost hotel, you know, $120 a night, you know, 200-room hotel. I mean, we also have a hotel downtown right now, so we were in that business, and we kind of like that business, and it's probably a direction we want to go to.
What's your hope for the ghostly residents that still roam the halls of the Statler City Hotel? What's the thing that you wish for them in the future with this building?
I hope they, you know, obviously if they move towards the light, I'm happy for that. And if they stay around, I'm happy for that also. They seem to be very content with the Statler. They seem to like the renovation as they've been going along. I don't feel like there's any kind of negative energies. I think that ever since we've started and doing more investigating, I think a lot of the spirits do enjoy the communicating. I think they do enjoy the investigations also. I think they want to get their message across. But sometimes, you know, when we do an investigation, sometimes spirits come from with the people that come for the investigation. Sometimes there's some of the communications not with a Statler spirit. You know, maybe it's just a guardian angel that's coming with somebody else that wants to communicate with us. So it's, but I do hope the spirits, you know, stay around. I enjoy the investigating. I know some of the teams that come in, they enjoy the investigating too. And some of the responses, you mean, I always learn something new every night I investigate there. And even though I've been involved with the building for the last 8 years, 9 years, but I always learn something new. And even some of the people that come in on the tours, you know, maybe they've worked at the building longer and before, and they know a little bit about more of the history and some people that have passed and some of the incidents that went on there too.
To find out more about the Statler City Hotel, you can visit statlercity.com. To find out more about the Statler City Ghost Tours, visit statlerghosttours.com. And that wraps up this episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, please press subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to us and give us a review as well. That would greatly help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that we indeed exist. Thank you for that support. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi for The Grave Talks. Thanks for listening.